Our tour begins at the Hervey School, 122 Sharon Street, at the corner of Sharon and Holton Streets, in Medford. Standing in front of the school, please listen to the following audio segments. In the autumn of 2005, Professor Mark Auslander of Brandeis University and his class entitled Museums and Public Memory encountered an opportunity they couldn't pass up. Counseled by Mr. Wallace Counts and many others, the class researched and assembled a history of the close-knit community of West Medford, Massachusetts, focusing primarily on its compelling Afro-American heritage. The goal was to present an engaging historical portrait of this community, based on the recorded accounts of its members. The exciting emerging technology of the iPod was chosen for utilization for an audio tour of the heart of the West Medford community. This tour is the result of many hours of dedicated work by the students, the members of the West Medford Afro-American Remembrance Committee, and other community partners. We sincerely hope that you are informed, enlightened, and most importantly, entertained.
Hi, I'm Mark Auslander in the Department of Anthropology at Brandeis University. On behalf of my students in the course, Museums and Public Memory, I'd like to welcome you to our digital audio walking tour of the historic Afro-American neighborhood of West Medford, Massachusetts. During fall 2005, we've worked with the West Medford Afro-American Remembrance Committee and many community members to record memories of how the neighborhood has developed and changed since the early 20th century. In the following tour, you'll hear student-edited audio segments on a range of topics. Some of these are about particular places in West Medford, such as Duggar Park, Old Shiloh Baptist Church, or the Little Store. Others are about broader themes, such as memories of wartime service or struggles against residential and educational segregation. In all of these segments, you'll hear some of the voices of West Medford sharing their memories of good times and hard times. You may listen to this audio tour online through our class weblog, or you may subscribe to our podcast and then listen to the tour through an iPod or any other digital audio device. If you have a chance to visit West Medford, please listen to the voices of the students and the community members as you walk along these historic streets and reflect along with us on the remarkable history of this neighborhood. Thank you.
Former and current residents Mrs. Alice Isaacs, Mrs. Smith, Mrs. Gloria Bowen, Mrs. Esther Ellis, Mrs. Jean Swan, and Mr. Wallace Count recall what the West Medford neighborhood was like in their own words.
Everyone on the street where you live knew you. They knew you.
Well, you know, now that you say that, it's interesting to note that the early people, the founders who came here from wherever they came from, mm-hmm. were all sane-minded and wanted to see opportunities and progress in this community,
right,
and work toward that end and eventually accomplish that, so that mm-hmm. when the 20s and 30s came and their children began to arrive, mm-hmm. they all had that mental knowledge, but they also had more opportunities.
We're getting into the heart of the Afro-American community now.
You know, going back to, again, the late 1800s, right through to the 1960s, etc., Jerome Street. Pretty much every home on this street during that time period was either rented or owned by an Afro-American. Changed dramatically. But the time period in question, this was pretty much the heart.
All the neighbors knew everybody. We also knew, as soon as they came in, we got to know them, so that it was like extended family.
One large extended family. I can't emphasize that enough. Everybody took care of everybody. If you were hungry, you'd go to Sonny's house, etc. Mm-hmm. Christmas Eve, he'd be at my home, etc. Just a very, very loving, enjoyable utopia.
The community seemed so close. Mm-hmm. You know, especially with the center and the church and everything, it seemed like it would bring everyone mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you ever had some kind of problem, you could go anywhere in the community to get help. Mm-hmm. Was that the kind of feeling you had?
It was truly a mm-hmm. village.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, it was.
West Medford was our hometown. It was utopia. Utopia. And I emphasize that. It was utopia.
This feeling of utopia for Wallace Counts and the West Medford community was as a result of the neighborhood acting as one large family. And like a family, each person had a role in supporting, disciplining, and shaping future generations of West Medford residents. Listen as Ione Vargas, Mrs. Isaacs, and Ms. Marilyn Smith recount their own experiences of this family feeling.
They made sure that I was home at night. They made sure I studied. They made sure I took my music lessons. They may even have helped some financially. But everybody in that community felt like, since I had no parent in the home, they were all sort of my parents. But now that again is not an unusual type situation in most small communities.
And we looked out for one another. Mm-hmm. Now, if you lived next door to me and I saw you doing something wrong, I could correct you. Mm-hmm. And your parents would appreciate it. Your parents could correct my children. Mm-hmm. And everyone around here was concerned about each other. Mm-hmm. And we helped people.
Whenever we got in trouble and one of our neighbors, as Wally said, we got spanked. And then we got sent home to be spanked again. But we knew who every single person was on our street. We knew the mother, the father, the kids. We knew the house number, the phone number. There was such an extended family from one end of Jerome Street to the other.
You are about to hear the neighborhood memories of the closely knit families and community of West Medford. Many have the preconceived notion that history is limited to dry textbooks, but you will soon see that it can be much more than that. The accounts of these West Medford inhabitants remind us of a time when community meant caring for one another. Neighbors weren't just people who lived next door, they were more like family. Listen to what this amazing community has to say about their love for their fellow man and woman. This is what it meant to be part of the neighborhood.
We looked out for one another. Mm-hmm. Now, if you lived next door to me and I saw you doing something wrong, I could correct you. Mm-hmm. And your parents would appreciate it. Your parents could correct my children. Mm-hmm. And everyone around here was concerned about each other. And we helped people. Mm-hmm. When I came out here, you immediately became a part of the community. Mm-hmm. See, so when I first came out here, a lady said to me, "I know who you are." I said, "You do?" She says, "You were Alice Willis, weren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And her son called me Ken. When he found out that his mother's great aunt was married to my uncle, he adopted me. So I'm his cousin or aunt or something like that.
One large extended family. I can't emphasize that enough. Everybody took care of everybody. If you were hungry, you'd go to Sonny's house, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Christmas Eve, he'd be at my home, et cetera. Just a very, very loving, enjoyable utopia.
Children in West Medford attended the Hervey School for elementary school. Listen to memories of the Hervey School, first from three sisters from the Fur family, Gloria Bowens, Esther Ellis, and Jean Swan. Afterwards, you'll hear stories from Wallace Counts and Marilyn Smith.
But we all went to the Hervey.
We all did.
Went to...
It was the neighborhood school.
Brooks,
everyone.
After that.
The Brooks school.
For sixth grade, Hobbs Junior High School, and then Senior High School,
yeah.
Right? And none of us went to kindergarten. They didn't have them then.
Mm-hmm.
First grade, you started
I did, but not in Medford, in Detroit, Michigan.
How many kids were in the school? Or in like first and second grade, were there a lot? Or?
The first grade class was a full class, so maybe 20 children.
Okay.
The second grade was two rows of second grade, two rows of third grade.
Ah.
The third grade, fourth and fifth, was two rows of fourth, two rows of fifth. And sixth grade was at the Brooks School. I remember that real well.
her.
We had great teachers.
Teachers.
Remember Mr. Sullivan at the high school? He would come and at night, after supper, he'd come with his books and he'd sell encyclopedias and everything to all the students. Yeah, he did.
That's true.
And I can remember thinking, this really bothered me. I was in high school in 1965. And he's busy telling us at school that this is a free country, everybody can vote, everybody can do all these things. And then I'd come home and look at my TV set and think, Mr. Sullivan's not telling the truth.
Yeah.
It was horrible. That was a horrible time to be in high school in the 50s because you knew that things weren't the way they should be.
Yeah.
And then you knew that weren't the way they were being taught in school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They made sure you could read.
Yeah.
Wonderful teachers.
Did they live in the community?
Yes. Brooks lived right in across from the Brooks School and down, I don't know the names of those streets.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning of like where the Lawrence Estates are, she lived there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right on High Street actually, her house was.
Yeah. I think Medford High School, most of Medford High School's teachers lived right here.
And Miss Lee lived in that apartment building next to the church, next to the Catholic Church.
St.
Mayfield. She lived in that building.
Because
I used to pay bills for Mom. I'd have to go to West Medford Square, and I'd see her walking home to her apartment building.
But there were very few black teachers.
No,
there weren't any.
And I felt badly for her. She didn't live in a home.
Yeah.
She lived in an apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
And how could that be? You know, I remember thinking that. But we were really brought up cloistered.
Yeah.
We really were.
Mm-hmm.
Where your teachers know your sisters and brothers,
and
know your parents.
Yeah.
You were just really protected or something.
It keeps everyone safe, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And the memories you have, you know, that you had a nice, safe childhood.
Yeah.
And you know that's not for everybody today.
Right.
Everybody doesn't have that.
Yeah.
So that makes you more compassionate, I think.
This is a community that went through some difficult times in terms of segregation, where some people said enough is enough, we're tired of going to a segregated school. Maybe the Herbert
School
I went to.
School, yeah.
It was back in the 70s, I believe, that the community took over the school.
Mm-hmm.
We took over the superintendent's office, said enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
Then they brought in desegregation and made the Herbert School, what did they call it, a special school?
Magnet school.
Yes.
Yeah.
So people from all over the city and Winchester out would bring their kids here because it was so professional in terms of giving younger kids a good grounding in education. Yeah.
But the problem with that is because there were so many kids from other areas coming, the kids in the neighborhood had to be put on a waiting list to go to their own neighborhood school.
What happened to the Hervey School, as well as other schools, what happened was, about 5 years ago, we got rid of the neighborhood schools. It was very, very controversial. And so a lot of the neighborhood schools have been sold. Like the Hervey School is now going through a condo development.
But you know, I loved the Hervey because I went to the Hervey, my son went to the Hervey, and they still had the small desk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was the school that I remember.
Yeah.
In fact, they're going to have to redo everything because it was for little people.
Yeah.
It was an elementary school and everything remained small.
In this piece, you will hear from Gloria Bowens, Esther Ellis, and Jean Swan, as well as Dr. Iona Vargas.
Desegregation of the school system in West Medford caused mixed feelings among the residents. Listen as three sisters recount their memories.
My baby was in the first year of school, first grade, and she had to be bused to the Gleason School because they were taking kids out of the Hervey and busing them elsewhere.
Mm.
I was terribly upset. Michelle had to go. I wanted her to go. But in order to make it so that it wasn't an all-black.
But when we went, it wasn't. I went to school, it was very integrated.
When I went to school, there weren't, this was not an all-black neighborhood.
Right.
And it isn't today either. It's going back to the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few black people in this neighborhood when I was a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
All of our neighbors were Italian or Irish.
Mm-hmm.
And
by the time I, well, because I had a lot of black friends on this street and Allen Street.
Yeah, because it had, that's when a lot of black people, after the war, started to move.
Yeah.
So that Hervey School was mostly all black students.
I never remembered that.
20 years after Brown versus Board of Education, in an effort to increase the diversity in the school system, Boston desegregated its schools by busing children to different locations.
We could go to the schools. That was not, they were not segregated. Now, the white kids were very often very, very hostile. They didn't, on hand, or they'd also always call you names. I mean, that we knew, too. You know, that was just like par for the course, and you knew that you were going to have to hear all these terrible words, you know, yelled at you and stuff like that. There were the other side, too. There were always the kids who were your friends, white kids who were your friends, too. And part of some of the organizations that fought not to have busing, we didn't want busing, we didn't want desegregation, we wanted better schools. And we didn't care whether it was black or white children, just if as long as it was black children, we wanted them to do better schools rather than to desegregate, rather than to do the busing.
A strong emphasis on education is perhaps one of the most defining characteristics of the West Medford community. Through hard work and dedicated commitment, the community has endeavored to make quality education a priority. Listen as Carlotta Frisbee recounts the creation of the first kindergarten in Medford, right in their own community.
Medford was in this community, and it was through the efforts of the people. I worked with people in Gilchrist that wanted to move to West Medford so they could send their kids to the kindergarten. And we had a kindergarten ever since.
The first kindergarten was not the only innovation. In 1963, while she was teaching at East Boston High School, the West Medford Improvement Association approached Madeline with a request to run for the Medford School Committee. Although no African-American woman had ever successfully run for such a position, either in Medford or in the state as a whole, Madeline agreed to try to recruit high-quality teachers, especially teachers of color, creating a racial balance plan for the Medford School, evaluating school building needs, strengthening the existing guidance program, and initiating a skills training program for students who did not wish to pursue higher education. One of the high-quality teachers hired in 1969, she became very active in the desegregation of the Hervey Elementary School in West Medford, working with other African-American parents who wanted equal treatment for their children. Through this process, she was one of a few African-American teachers hired at the Hervey in 1970. At that time, it became a K-3 magnet school. For many people in West Medford, education did not end with high school. An agreement with Tufts allowed many students to start attending university classes while still enrolled in high school, so that they would be prepared for the rigors of college education upon their graduation. Listen as one of the Fur Sisters recounts her days in these classes.
Tufts had made an arrangement with Medford High School that some of its best English students could go there on Saturday morning if they were college bound, and they could sit in classes, any class that they chose, and take notes, learn how to take very organized notes. And that would be a skill that would help them by the time you got to college.
Right.
You know, I mean, nobody made big deal out of it. Tufts opened up the doors. We went.
Mm-hmm.
We were students who sat across the back of the room, and we learned how to take notes from the course. And I was going to be a biology major, so not only did I have to take notes, but I had to learn how to draw pictures. But I swear that when you get to Tufts, find somebody who can draw. You take the notes. Let them take the drawing and then put the thing together after class, and that's what I did.
Even once accepted into college, it wasn't always easy for West Medford students to attend. Listen as Mrs. Dorothy Elizabeth Tucker details the community's involvement in getting their children through college.
And all of us have supported somebody else in terms of their education, and not necessarily our kids, somebody else's kids as well.
The commitment in West Medford to supporting education is a centerpiece of the interpersonal bonds that have built this community. With the many steps taken to improve education over the years, the West Medford community has instilled the values of hard work and community support in residents of all races, economic backgrounds, and of all generations.
Now walk one block west on Sharon Street. Make a right onto Harvard Ave, walking towards the Mystic River. Turn right on Jerome Street.
As you come across the corner of Jerome and Harvard Ave, you'll see a simple gray house. However, in the 1940s and 50s, this was the location of the locally renowned Mr. Henry's Little Store. Far from the overly commercial convenience stores of today, Mr. Henry's was a place where the community of Medford was welcomed with open arms. Children of the era recall spending much time with friends bargaining with the shopkeep over penny candy and simply hanging around the shop with one another to pass the time. Certainly, life has changed since the days of the little store. Although it isn't an official West Medford landmark, it will always exist in the memories of those who once knew of its charm.
It's a landmark in Medford, the little store.
This gray house was a little store, and it was called Mr. Henry's, and he sold penny candy.
Mm-hmm.
I found this bottle cap. How many pieces of candy will I buy? Because he would do that. We didn't have to have money. He knew we didn't have a job, or we would walk around and we would find bottles, Coke bottles.
Yeah.
And he would redeem them for us. I don't know what he did with them, but he was wonderful. And we used to get the wax lip.
Oh, yeah.
On those for hours. I'm trying to think of the candy. Of course, we had squirrel nuts. We had Mary Jane's, mint juleps.
And he had a jukebox in there. He sold ice cream.
Everything. He sold everything. Popcorn.
Popcorn, yeah. It wasn't the cleanest place. But, you know, we didn't know any different. It was just a place for us to gather. And we were quoting the girls at that time at the store, you know, and the girls would be... It was just great. Just great.
And he let us hang in there as long as we want. Never kicked us out.
No.
Never did.
So anyway, it's a landmark in Medford, the little store. Okay.
There's not a plaque there.
Not a plaque there, no.
No, not a plaque.
Retrace your steps and make a right back onto Harvard Street, walking to Duggar Park at the corner of Harvard Ave and Mystic River Road. As one of the focal points of the community that includes many happy memories of family and community solidarity, Duggar Park, as one of the first public parks and playgrounds in Medford, stands as one of the most important sites in West Medford. Bringing together the young and the old through sports, mentoring, tennis, fishing, and most importantly field days, Duggar, dedicated in 1939, presents to its viewer an image of the past, the present, and the future. Listen to the following accounts from Mr. Wallace Counts, Sonny, also known as Mr. Hilton Parham Jr., Miss Marilyn Smith, the Fur Sisters, and Mrs. Alice Isaacs, as they tell us about their memories spent in this wonderful, wonderful place. Duggar Park is named for Lieutenant Colonel Edward Duggar. He faithfully served in the United States Armed Forces, and he defended this country during World War I. As a resident of West Medford, he was very active in civic and community organizations, including the Medford Planning Board, the Men's Community Club, and the Boy Scouts. West Medford residents praised his memory by dedicating the park in his honor for his great contribution to the community. Source, booklet from Dedication of Duggar Park, September 10, 1939, Ethel Evans.
Listen to Wallace Counts as he explains the significance of Duggar Park.
A lot of history here. Duggar Park happens to be named after my grandfather, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Duggar, who was a Lieutenant Colonel in World War I. How he achieved that rank in World War I beats me. But this park was named after him on September 10th of 1939. It's the first public park and playground effort in other suburban towns ever named after an Afro-American. So much has happened here under the Sonny and Marilyn. It's one of the better parks in the city.
Please listen as Sonny, or Hilton Parham Jr., Wallace Counts, and Marilyn Smith recall their memories of water activities in the park.
The river itself has a history all its own. If anyone wants to speak to the river for 3 minutes, what we used to do in the river, swim,
fish. When everybody else was doing something else, I was always down here fishing.
He was an expert fisherman. Yeah, he really was in his day.
I fished this river from way up to Mystic Lakes all the way down to Mystic Square. What could you catch in here?
Largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, perch, white perch,
eels,
bluegills.
Turtles.
Like this, right?
Wow.
Yeah. Only thing, they're long gone. No such thing out of a reward.
Plus, they stock it now.
Yeah, muskrats, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, they stock it now?
Yeah. But they stock it from the Mystic Lake.
There's a swim here also, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This down
is
there
beach.
Is a swimming beach. Here was a baseball. This was a baseball field. And in the wintertime, the fire department used to come down here and flood this so that we'd have an ice skating rink.
Yeah.
And, because we used to play a lot of hockey, you know. And hockey is one of our favorite sports in the winter.
Do they flood it anymore?
No.
Yeah.
No.
And this is Duggar Park here?
Yeah.
Got the basketball court.
Yeah. Now, see, when I came up, this was not here. You know, this was a baseball field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we played baseball here.
And where's the diamond now?
Well, it's all gone now. You know, this was our baseball field, but they turned it into a basketball court.
Sports was and is a vital component of Duggar Park. Clarence Roan, Julie Oliver, and Walter Isaacs all had a major influence on sports in the park. The tennis courts are named after Clarence Roan, who was considered, quote, father of local tennis, end quote. This local businessman inspired the young and old alike to enjoy the sport of tennis. Julie Oliver was known for setting up Labor Day tennis tournaments, which brought the community together. She was a former president of the West Medford Tennis Association. Finally, Walter Isaacs mentored youth in sports and through life. As a coach of youth baseball, tennis, and bowling, he helped to empower and motivate youth to reach their full potential. Source: Walter Isaacs and Tough student Kenneth Leary, also West Medford Afro-American Remembrance Project.
From here, you can tell the kind of events that we did. The sack race, girls and boys.
And not only that, there was always the activity down at the park.
Music is a whole neighborhood.
What an African culture. Afro-American culture. It brings us all together. The kids will come down here, all ages.
Yeah.
It would be a day-long field day, wouldn't it, Marilyn?
Yeah, all day. They block the street off.
They block the streets off.
Drive down.
It's like a block.
Not
the same, no. It's lost a little bit of its rhythm, hasn't it, Marilyn?
Yeah, we used to play games. You know, three-legged races.
Yeah.
My dad had arthritis in his back, and that was the one time he could run.
They used to have semi-pro baseball teams from here. Some of these fellas that played ball, they could easily be professional ball players in the big leagues if they would let them play.
Mm-hmm. Summer League has a basketball game here every Tuesday and Thursday, and they still do that. Tuesday and Thursdays.
A lot of good fellowship amongst the races here as well.
Yeah,
you'll see people, different ethnic groups playing basketball together. And that's healthy.
Yeah.
That's very, very healthy. This is a community that went through some difficult times in terms of segregation where some people said enough is enough.
Continue walking west along Mystic River Road, passing by the tennis courts on the left. The tennis courts by the park are another example of how individuals contributed greatly to the benefit of the community. Just after the basketball courts stands a stone monument to Julie Oliver, a resident who volunteered to coordinate community tournaments.
But every Labor Day, she was the one that pretty much coordinated annual tennis tournaments down the park. And again, this is one of the best tennis courts in the city. That's Julie Oliver. We miss her very, very much.
Clarence Roan took an interest in sharing his joy of the game of tennis with neighborhood residents. This passion resulted in what you see today, neighborhood courts that are of such quality that the West Medford High School students use them for their games. Wallace Counts speaks of Mr. Roan and his love of the game.
Mr. Roan was a businessman, I'm going back to the 30s now. He lived across the street where you see those several cars parked. He had a moving van company, and his specialty was moving pianos. And he would hire guys that just could not find any other work. And he made a strong contribution. But as a fella growing up, he just loved tennis. He was a big guy, but he was very agile on his feet. And he got us all involved in learning how to play tennis, including Julie and myself. And so we really took to tennis very, very much. Tennis court down here, and
he was just a master at tennis. And again, where you see those four or five cars, that was his home. And where those four or five cars are, when Sonny and I were kids in Maryland, you see moving vans, Roan Moving Company.
Yeah, he had a slogan on his billboard.
What was it, Sonny?
Phone Roan when calling for Holland.
Okay.
Say the phrase again.
Phone Roan when calling for Holland.
Make a right on Mystic River Road and go about 50 yards west, and on the left, stop at the site of the West Medford Community Center.
The Community Center was an integral part of West Medford. Listen in as community members share their memories.
We had a community center.
To get this lot, they have the original Arlington Street lot and made arrangements to purchase the house next door.
A one-story army barracks that they put there, and they call it the West Medford Community Center.
Founded around in the 1930s sometime. In fact, my father was alive when it was founded because he was the first president.
We had good people that ran it. You know, wasn't just no anybody.
We had some notable people who came and had programs at the community center. Then they went off to Boston and elsewhere, and they became very well publicized.
Right. We used to have brownie meetings there after school.
Oh, yeah.
And after school Bible meetings and
babysitting, sewing lessons, cooking.
All kinds of lessons. Cooking lessons and things like that.
They had spaghetti dinners. They had not just spaghetti dinners. They would have dinners once a month down at the community center, and there were no women allowed. The men did that, and they did it very well.
My husband used to show black and white movies on Saturdays at the community center in the summer. And my neighbor across, around the corner, and I, we would chaperone.
And they had summer programs for kids also.
It would be after school. Tufts University young people would come and volunteer.
But they did all the dances were there for the kids. Friday night, that was the place to be, you know, just everybody would come to the dances.
Didn't they have dances and things there for the soldiers?
Sure.
And
Yeah. Are you kidding? That's where you met everybody.
When they had those dances, you know, I was there to make the boys take the hats off.
It was jumping Friday night.
Merge on to Arlington Street. On the left, by the river, are the flats.
In the first book of John, chapter 1, we find the passage, "If we claim to have fellowship with him, yet walk in the darkness, we lie and do not live by the truth. But if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another." If one word could describe the essence of the West Medford community, it is fellowship. To those who live there, the term extends beyond the conventional religious meaning. Listen as Wally Count, Marilyn Smith, and Mrs. Catherine Smith discuss memories of fellowship and what the word means to them.
The fellowship is socializing, I feel. Well, it would be the same thing as you all use as hanging out.
This is known as the Flats. Got a little history there.
The Flats.
The Flats, okay. The Flats. I want to say this is a non-debit. This is where guys would come and have a sip of beer, have a glass of wine, you know, and just fellowship on their own. I mean, from the little store, what was there?
The store.
It was where we would come in after high school to school and fellowship with us. And he had a jukebox in there. He sold ice cream.
Everything. He sold everything.
Popcorn. Popcorn, yeah. It wasn't the cleanest place. You know, we didn't know any different.
There was a strong spiritual fellowship that really kept the families here in close communication. A lot of honesty as well.
Easter Sunday, I remember, we would get up at 5 o'clock, go down to the park, and we would have what they call the sunrise service, where we would fellowship down at the park by the river, and then we would come back to the church for the baptism, and we would fellowship at the breakfast.
Fellowship. You fellowship with people. You show them friendship, acceptance, spending time with them. And that's all it is. You go to church for fellowship, for friendship, for support, you know, emotional support. And maybe mine is different. from the dictionary. Mm-hmm. But at least that's what it means to me. That's what it means, you know, that's what I would expect it to mean. Anytime you take time out to be nice to somebody. And it doesn't just have to be through worship, but it's just extending a hand in friendship.
At the intersection of Arlington Street and Route 60, in the middle of the Rotary, is a memorial to Vietnam veterans from Medford. Be careful as you cross this busy street to Nelson Circle.
This is the story of four Vietnam veterans from the West Medford community.
My name is John Webster. I was in the United States Air Force. I was a sergeant with the 3rd Security Police Squadron in Vietnam and the 633rd in Vietnam. I was 21 years old when I went to Vietnam. I grew up in the city of Somerville, and I went into the Air Force in 1966. And in 1967, November 15th, 1967, I landed in Vietnam. Presently, I work as a veterans agent for the city of Malta.
Paul Edward Pina. I was a E-4 buck sergeant in the United States Air Force between 1967 and 1971. Two tours in Southeast Asia, first one in Vietnam, second one in Thailand, supporting the Vietnam War. Get out in 1971 after doing 4 years of active duty service.
My name is Lee Enos, and I was in the service from 1971 to 1975. I was in the Air Force Security Police Branch. But just so you know, I wasn't in Vietnam. I was in the service during the Vietnam conflict.
Okay.
But I never went into the country itself. I traveled around. I ended up, first out of country tour was in Turkey. And then I came back and they put me up in New Hampshire. And then I went temporary duty up to Goose Bay, Labrador. And then I came back to New Hampshire and I finished up my time there.
Okay, I'm Edward F. O'Brien, Jr. from Medford. I grew up in Medford my whole life, and I'll be 56 years old in a couple of days. I enlisted in the Army for 2 years in 1971. I was one of the last ones in Vietnam as a combat soldier. In 1972, I was with the 1st Cavalry Division. So I did 6.5 months in Vietnam, and I came home in August of 70. I was a sergeant, and it was quite an experience.
Return across the street and walk east on Jerome Street. On the right, at 13 Jerome Street, is the former site of the Kelly Stables and Riding School.
The Kelly Stables and Riding School, located at 13 Jerome Street, holds a special place in the minds of Hilton Parham, or Sonny, Wally Counts, and Marilyn Smith, all three of whom took our class up and down the streets of West Medford for a walking tour. When we approached the barn, which still stands in the midst of new houses, many fond memories of taking riding lessons surfaced. As we will hear in the following anecdotes from Sonny, Wally, and Marilyn, this school was indeed unique, both for an Afro-American neighborhood and an East Coast community at the time as well. The Jerome Street Riding School, as it was named, is said to have been one of the finest schools on the East Coast.
Original barn, owned by the Kelly family.
Afro-Americans?
Yeah. They used to rent horses. They also rented out buggies. They also did hay rides one time. But it was a riding school.
A riding school?
Yeah, but they did very good. I know I used to rent horses. I think it cost like $1 to ride for about 3 hours. But I stopped because the horse I went on stumbled. I always went over his head. And I said, that's enough riding for me.
It was a very successful, profitable business. Yeah. Now, the time frame on this one was possibly late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
Unheard of for people in America to be in business for themselves.
Yeah. Now, I used to ride. We took the horses down Jerome Street, came up Arlington, Mystic River Road, and came back this way.
Yeah.
So even as a kid, we would take the horses down Jerome Street.
Yeah.
And some of the issues would have hay rides.
Oh.
Yeah.
Snow on the ground, have sleigh rides.
Sleigh rides.
It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
In fact, this was all part of the riding stable, these new houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we'd get the horses here and we'd just take them all around. But of course, as people moved into the neighborhood and you've got cars now, it just really wasn't feasible because they did have at one point 15 horses and we had to save our allowance. Do our chores, save our allowance, and then we'd walk down Jerome Street and take a horse in the afternoon. And if you were a regular, then you could basically take the horses to the Mystic Lakes without a guide.
From the stables, proceed two blocks down Jerome Street. At the diagonal intersection of Sherman and Jerome, you will see a small memorial for World War II veterans dedicated on July 4, 1946. As well as a memorial for Elmer Kuntz, veteran, dedicated on August 24, 1991, for his civic contributions to the city of Medford.
Wally Kuntz describes the significance of the local World War II memorial to West Medford today.
Outstanding. Yeah. Was dedicated about the first week in October.
Right in the center of Medford. Right next
to the temple.
Yeah, okay. To the temple and the high school.
The temple gave the city the land to put the temple there. A fantastic ceremony, I guess, the first week in October.
Yeah.
Just heart-rendering ceremony. Yeah. Dedicated to the veterans that enlisted from Medford.
Yeah, because a lot of them didn't get their diplomas because they had to fight in the war, leave school. Fight in the war,
and they came back and
Some of them didn't come back. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Those who didn't come back, there's a star on their name on this memorial. I think there's probably close to 9,000 names on that memorial.
Yeah.
It's right. You go up there now, you see people looking at their family names. It's just beautiful. Just beautiful.
You know, there are very few World War II veterans around. They're down in the country about 1,000 a day, as you know. During World War II, everybody and his brother was in the service. Yeah. And I think we have one left, Whitfield Justice, World War II.
Mm-hmm. My cousin, Lloyd.
Lloyd lives up in Buzzards Bay, right, Sonny? Yeah.
Miss Carlotta Frisbee recalls her husband Herbert's experience in World War II, from the draft to coming home.
So he didn't know what he was going to do. I said, you know what you got to do. Uncle Sam going to call. You know where you're going. I called down to the recruit. I don't know who he is, but I don't know what anybody else ever went through all this. I told him that I was expecting and my husband was going into service and I was all alone and blah, 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 blah. Don't you know they were nice enough?
Wow.
You wouldn't believe this. This is a true story. And they deferred him for 3 months. And 3 months to the day, he got this call, you know, that he had to report. The recruiter came to our house, drove him, and I went with him to South Station. And I was standing at South Station when I thought it was a troop train that came in. And was another woman there. And her, I don't know that story to this day. But then was another woman there. And you know how these guys all waving and just carrying on at South Station. And we, the two of us, we stood there and we screeched and screamed and put on a show before, because our husbands, we didn't get got on that train. We didn't know where they were going, you know. What is one of them? Well, when they got to Liverpool, they decided that because the war in the Pacific was closing down, why send these fellas to the Pacific when the war is over and they are, you just rather send them on back to America? And that's what happened.
Although many soldiers left West Medford to serve during World War II, they were still very connected to their home. West Medford was just as committed to the soldiers as the soldiers were to their home during and after the war. Listen as three sisters, Mrs. Gloria Bowens, Mrs. Esther Ellis, and Mrs. Jean Swan, remember how the Ladies Auxiliary Group and the Lend a Hand Club supported the soldiers.
They were serious. They got together and cooked, those women, and made these packages, and they sent them often to the soldiers, right? Uh-huh.
Mrs. Carlotta Frisbee fondly remembers the involvement of the soldiers in the West Medford Community Center after they returned home for more.
And they stayed involved, and that was how we got that building down there. All of them stayed involved. But you don't find those kind of young people today, not out here. But they were very, very active. We had families of brothers when it was in World War II, and all lieutenants. And in fact, all the, most of them are passed now.
Continue a half block more on Jerome. Make a right onto Fairfield and go to the corner of Lincoln and Fairfield Streets. On the far left corner, you will see the former site of Old Shiloh Baptist Church.
On May 4, 1898, in West Medford, Massachusetts, the Shiloh Baptist Mission held a meeting for the purpose of organizing a Baptist church on Lincoln Street. Reverend Grice was asked to be pastor of the newly founded church. On December 7, 1900, the cornerstone of the church building was set in place. On January 30, 1905, the church was incorporated and church officers and a board of trustees was named. The officers included Lucius Banks, Alice Stewart, and Mrs. Herbert Kelly, while the board included Lucius Banks, J.E. Jeffers, and F.S. Furr. On May 15, 1966, after outgrowing the Lincoln Street building, Shiloh Baptist Church moved to a new location on Holton Street, where the congregation continues to worship today. Now listen as Wallace Counts, Iona Vargas, Gloria Bowens, Mrs. Catherine Smith, Mrs. Alice Isaacs, and Marilyn Smith discuss the role of Shiloh Baptist Church in the West Medford community.
The people that came here in those two generations, going back to the late 1800s, came here with socioeconomic conditions that were very, very poor. How did they survive? The glue was the church. The glue was the church.
As in many small communities, the church was the focus of, of the social life as well as the spiritual life and everything.
It was nice to be married there because I met my husband there. While I had the children were young, I felt we all needed to attend church together as a family.
Our children grew up in the church.
We spent at least 2 to 3 days a week in church, whether it was for youth activity, whether it was Bible study, or a meeting, but this is where we were.
According to a biography written by Gwyn Langley, a Tufts student, Reverend Dr. Oscar George, O.G. Phillips, served as the pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church for 43 years. He was very committed to the church and the West Medford community, as was his wife Miriam, whom he married in 1954. Through their efforts, the church became a sanctuary where people could come to discuss all issues affecting their community. Reverend Phillips retired in 1993 and passed away on September 4, 2005. Listen as Mrs. Catherine Smith discusses the contributions made to the church and the community by Reverend Phillips and his devoted wife.
And I was very happy with Dr. Phillips, O.G. Phillips, wonderful man. It's a funny thing what an impact he had. He and his wife were both very good with at the church. They introduced us to a lot of things. They had well-attended Bible studies for the adults, for the children. We had Sunday school. We had the vacation Bible school. And we used to interact with other churches. And it was very informative. So that's another reason, I enjoyed the church very much. And most people did. We had quite a large congregation.
Listen as Marilyn Smith, Mrs. Catherine Smith, and Mrs. Alice Isaacs discuss the congregation of Shiloh Baptist Church and the way in which it welcomed new members from many different backgrounds.
This was where everybody came to church. Any family that lived in West Memphis came to Shiloh Baptist.
We had people from all walks of life and all kinds of religious beliefs attend our church.
Many of the people who came would join the church. Many of them were not Baptist, but became interested and were baptized in the pool. And then there were others who came. There were different denominations. We had several Episcopalian families here. And then we had, of course, we've always had Roman Catholics.
Now Mrs. Catherine Smith describes her own experience of joining Shiloh Baptist Church.
I decided to become a member. through baptism. We had to have immersion. In fact, when I was baptized, there were two Catholics, Roman Catholics, mm-hmm. who attended the church out here, St. Rayfield's, and there were two Episcopalians, and we were all baptized at the same time. We were all married women with children, so we were adults, and we were all friends.
In this segment, Mrs. Alice Isaacs, Marilyn Smith, and Mrs. Catherine Smith share their memories of church activities and holiday services. These special events provided opportunities for the community to gather in a spirit of worship and celebration.
We used to have a lovely Easter program and Christmas programs, mm-hmm. and then we used to have pageants and plays and that mm-hmm. type of thing, and concerts. We used to do a lot of that.
Easter Sunday, I remember we would get up at 5 o'clock, go down to the park, and we would have what they call the sunrise service, where we would fellowship down at the park by the river, and then we would come back to the church for the baptism. And that's where we were immersed. And it was so beautiful. And it was nice because then afterwards we would have a breakfast, and we would fellowship at the breakfast, and then come back later for the regular morning service.
We always had the Christmas Eve service. We had service New Year's Eve, and that was for the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
On New Year's Eve, you know how they would have the parties, and everybody's mm-hmm. gone. You know, they're going to go out and celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they always made it a point to go to church first. So as a consequence, they were kind of late for the, for the midnight gong.
During the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, cars were an expensive luxury item to own, especially during World War I and II. Walking and public transportation were the main modes of travel for West Medford residents. Going to school, to work, the hairdresser, and attending church had all been activities that had to be close to home. And in the West Medford neighborhood, they were. Listen along as West Medford residents speak about cars and their introduction into the community through the changes, challenges, and progress that they brought.
I said that you didn't have cars, so you either walked where you were going or you used the bus.
When everybody was in the service, Wally's mother could always drive. Mm. And she'd take a bunch of us to Somerville to get rations.
Automobiles, very few. Very few and far between. Again, the men in Sonny's generation, our parents had to work two and three jobs just to keep food on the table, notwithstanding a car. If one bought a car, it was a big dinghy.
We came from Philadelphia, but we drove in our own car. But the other car, we used to play tennis out in the park on Sunday, and that was the comicalest thing, because ever so you have a good time out. That's where you threw out. It was just a lot of fun. And this couple would disappear, and you knew they had bought a car and was gone somewhere. And ended up until there was nobody out there in the park. Oh. Everybody had a car. Funny, funny, funny.
A putmobile?
Putmobile. They don't, but they stopped making them back in like 1939. Yeah. It was a good, nice car. Yeah.
A sense of civic responsibility was one of the knitting needles that worked together families, friends, and neighbors in the West Medford community. Listen along as Mrs. Carlotta Frisbee and Mrs. Isaacs speak about one of those civic responsibilities, exercising their right to vote.
When I became 18, my mother said to me, she used to do this, she says, "You're 18 years old now, you're old enough to register to vote." And I said, "Well, what do I want to vote for?" My mother said, "This is your country." She said, "In the South, colored people are not allowed to vote," which is true, but that didn't happen until the 60s. She says, "Ministers, professors, doctors, teachers, and she named everybody down to the sharecropper. They are not allowed to vote. Up here in the North, we are allowed to vote. You are going to march yourself down to City Hall and register to vote. And you register Republican. So I marched down to City Hall. I'll never forget this. And she was a little woman. So when I came back, she says, well, she says, Miss Willis, that was sarcasm. Did you register to vote? And I said, yes, Mama. She says, now you can help run this country.
I started, when I first started out, I'm from the South.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were always Republicans. At that time, I didn't know this one party from another. But I remember that in talking, they were Republicans. They always voted Republican. So naturally, we had to sign up before we graduated from college down there, we had to sign up. So I signed up, and I signed up as a Republican. But when I got back, when I came, I guess I did vote for Republican when I first got in there, but I became a Democrat with Roosevelt. And I've been a Democrat ever since. But you know something? My husband was a Republican. He never changed. And when we'd go up here to vote, they said, here come the mixed house.